I need somebody. Help. Not just anybody. Help. You know I need someone. Help.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to what will soon be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. We're glad you're with us tonight, whether it was on purpose or by accident. Either way, we'll take it. Bill Arnold on this side of the chicken wire, and on the other side is George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Bill, how are you doing today?
Great. We've got a very exciting show. I've been after Michael Cusick for a while to be on the show, and we have him tonight on the air.
I'm really looking forward to this. This is a great topic. I think all men struggle with this, and I think we just roll. Let's get going here.
Well, wait a second, George. Back up just a little, okay? Let's just talk about step one real quick, and then we'll bring him on.
Okay. Sounds good.
We like to talk about steps.
We do.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Always like that intro, too. I love that song, and Help, I Need Help. And we're talking about step one tonight. And if you're new to our program, what we talk about is this is real recovery. And we believe that all Christians are in recovery because we should be changed by the power of Jesus Christ from what we used to be. And we also deal with alcohol, drugs, sex, gambling. They're all God's substitutes. And, Bill, we look at addiction is really idolatry. So if you've stopped a behavior through a 12-step program or some other way, that's great. But you don't have recovery without Jesus. Addiction is idolatry. Recovery without Jesus is still idolatry. And what we do is we move along and get God substitutes. And maybe we switch, Bill. Maybe we stop drinking and we start gambling. Maybe we look at porn. Anything to change how we feel, get a little excitement. And I know in my life a few years ago, I was working with some clients, and they always had cocaine and pornography together. And, Bill, when I was active in my cocaine use, those two went together. And a few years ago, somebody sent me an email that had some porn on it, and I opened it up and looked at it. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a psychologist, and I said, gosh, you know, I could remember that. I was playing golf that day, and I was thinking about that. And he said, George, that's because it hits the same part of your brain that cocaine does. And he said, you got to stay away from it. The relapse process starts when we start turning away from God. And this is a way, Bill, we've seen a lot of guys we work with go back to using. You know, there's romance, there's finance, and it's another drug. And doggone it, if it's really hard to erase from your mind those images.
I agree. And, George, you know, technology, we create technology, then it turns around and recreates us.
You know, good.
How is it possible that you get a porn video sent to your phone on the golf course? I mean, think of the possibilities. Think of the fact that there was a time growing up where when the phone rang, it was one phone in the middle of the house, and when you got on it, everyone could hear your conversation.
You're right.
So Friday night would roll around. You'd go, well, your mom would say, where are you off to? And you go, well, I'm going to the movies with Bob. And she'd say, well, will there be beer at Julie's party? It's like, how did you know?
Yeah.
Because she overhears everything. Now we have technology. We create our own little worlds. We take our phones into anywhere we want and create conversation, and we make plans. And I have a friend who makes reference to laptop computers as naked lady machines.
I see that.
So much of what people do on computers is seek out porn. So we have the ultimate expert on the show tonight, and I read his book, and I passed it on to many people, made a copy of it on the machine, the photocopy machine, and sent it out to a lot of people.
They like that. That way they don't sell as many books. So I'm sure he appreciates that. Bill, there's some things I don't think we're meant to see, and this is one of them. And if I look at the Bible back in the book of Genesis, Joseph with Potiphar's wife, he ran out of there. She was holding his garment. And King David, a man after God's own heart, I can't go anywhere near this stuff because it gets me back into my using mentality. But you know what? The other night I was sitting around thinking, I haven't watched that in a while. That would be exciting.
You sitting around. Can't imagine that.
No. Well, you know, the laundry was all done. It was Saturday night and things were going. But it speaks to you out there that, hey, this is exciting. This is fun. And the book of James talks about we're enticed by our own sin.
And, George, your point's well taken. You know, the whole idea of, you know, 1 Corinthians 10 talks about no temptation has seized you. Michael makes a great point in his book where he said, you know, in verse 14, it says, therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. In other words, you got to get away from it.
Well, so, we got to be honest. I mean, if I go to the bakery, I'm going to get some donuts, okay? My off button's broken.
It's quite broken.
It is broken.
Yeah.
And this is a topic that I can't wait to get to with Michael because I think every guy struggles with this.
Well, George, why should we talk about Michael's book when we actually have him on the line?
Good point,
Bill. Let's get started. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here, and I'm laughing already.
Ah, terrific. Well, we...
just glad you didn't hang up. We're good to go here, yeah.
Michael, I think one of the premises in my life is if the Holy Spirit is not there to restrain me, there's going to be trouble.
That's a pretty good premise, yeah, and I love the idea of the off button is broken. I wrote that one down. So in some ways, the Holy Spirit is our off button, but also the on button for the things that we do desire most deeply.
Yeah, and one of the lines out of your book it was, you can't be the solution to the lie when you're the one telling it.
Huh, did I say that?
That's good.
Yeah, I think you did.
Okay.
It's a brilliant line, and if you didn't, then let's just say said it. One of us should get credit for it.
I'm taking notes on this conversation already. This is profound. But I think you touch on the whole idea of self-deception. And Gerald May said that self-deception is the chief characteristic of addiction, that if self-deception is not there, then all the other dominoes, if you will, fall out of place. And whether it's deceiving ourselves that it won't matter, that we won't get caught, that just this one time, that it's not that big of a deal, we're constantly deceiving ourselves. And you already mentioned the passage in James 1. Right after that, it says, don't be deceived, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift comes down from above. And so the idea of deception is that we can get good gifts without having to bow down and worship the Creator and to live in alignment with the way that He designed us. And, you know, porn and cocaine and alcohol and any other addiction is just one form of gift, quote unquote, that's not from the Creator, but a gift that has a great payoff on the front end and then turns around and bites us in the behind, and we wonder, why did we ever do this?
That is so good. It starts off as a good idea. Bill, all my sins are either fun or it's going to make things better, and that's a lie, and that's where we get caught up.
I agree.
Yeah.
What I want to ask Michael, and I think you will concur, is our brains need serious rebooting, and don't we have neural pathways that are just trained to respond to these dopamine highs that we get from things like cocaine and pornography and some of these other things that we just simply are wired to want from the beginning.
We're absolutely wired to want, and so we have God-given desires in our heart that are very, very deep thirsts, hungers, and appetites, and we're also wired to attach. And so historically, if you were to go back 2,000 years in the church and from about the 4th century forward, you start to see spiritual writers talking about the word attachment. And before they understood about the brain and before the word addiction was in place, attachment was how we take this capacity for us as human beings to be attached and connected to another human being, and we suddenly attach ourselves and our heart, our spiritual emotional heart, to something, to some person, to some substance, to some behavior, and those all mimic the kind of attachment that we were created for. And so when we do that, our brains respond as if we're attaching. But anything that you give our heart to, as you suggested, if it's not God or one of His good gifts, it's an idol. And when you give your heart to something, person, process, substance, or behavior, then it will enslave you. And that's where addiction comes in. And what happens, because we're biological beings, is that our brain gets enslaved as well. And those neural pathways develop because of this counterfeit attachment. With pornography, the major, major issue that a lot of people don't understand, and especially guys over, I'm going to be 50 this year, but especially guys like over 40 who may have been exposed to, or their primary knowledge of pornography was magazines and VHS tapes. That's qualitatively different from what's on the internet today. And the idea of novelty, which is if when I was a kid and I found a porn magazine in a field, that kind of became old. Even as a boy, the novelty was like, okay, well, I've kind of seen that before. But with the internet, a person can see hundreds and thousands of images within a very, very short amount of time. So within an hour, someone has suggested a 15-year-old boy might see more images of naked people than in 1800 someone did in their entire life. Or that might actually happen in 10 seconds. But that novelty overstimulates the brain so that more dopamine, which is the I gotta have it chemical, the gimme, gimme, gimme chemical, more dopamine is being stimulated than would possibly happen under any other conditions.
Hmm.
Cocaine will do it, but with the novelty of the images on the internet, suddenly the brain is just in hyper drive and hyper-stimulated.
Michael, we're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to, now that we have the stage set, we're going to ask you to unfold your story a little bit. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser. We'll be back in a second. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold, George Fraser in the studio tonight with limited adult supervision. George, we've got a fascinating guest on the show tonight. Michael Cusick is with us tonight. He's talking about his book, Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle. Something that, like you say, every man, the only men that don't struggle with it are the men who have never seen it. Is that right?
Kind of close, yeah. The only men that have a problem with porn are men that have seen it.
There you go. And Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
So give us a little sketch of your history with the subject tonight.
Sure. Well, I was I'm 50 years old next month, and I was born into an Irish Catholic alcoholic family, and I started my first addiction at age 5 when I attended an AA meeting with my dad, and he was the treasurer of the meeting. And so I was left to hang out at the coffee urn and took a styrofoam cup and filled it half with black sludge coffee and then took the sugar pourer and poured sugar into it until the level raised up to the top. And at age 5 until now, I've been addicted to coffee, caffeine, and a whole host of other substances. So I started young and also grew up in the 12 steps, AA, and a variety of recovery programs. Having said that, my Catholic faith kind of waxed and waned, and it was never really an important part of my life. It felt like an add-on of rules and regulations, and God was the cop in the sky, so to speak, that wanted to write a ticket when I broke the rules. And when I was 16 years old, I had a pretty profound conversion experience where I encountered a loving God and a gracious and merciful God who actually wanted a relationship with me. And so my life began to change, and I dove into that head first. And I thought, wow, this is great. Now I have this power in my life to overcome what had become a porn addiction to magazines and videos. And I was also sexually abused early on. And so I was carrying around all this junk and brokenness and shame in my life. And because of my newfound faith, my struggle and my addiction actually went underground. I developed the belief that I can't talk about this. I have to use my religion to be a good person instead of, I now have a place to go to be who I really am, and I can be loved for who I am. So, as we all know, addiction flourishes in secret, and my addiction flourished until I was 29 years old. In July 1994, I came home from work one day, got caught in a lie. I was married 3 years, and my addiction had escalated to not only porn, but massage parlors, escorts, prostitutes, just women in general. And everything came unfurling that day, the worst day of my life and the best day of my life. But because that was the first time at 29 years old when everything was out in the open and I realized I've got to make a decision here. Will I let myself be exactly who I am and risk being loved for who I am, or will I continue to try to hold it together and tell lies and fake it till I make it? And by God's grace, I'm still married to that same woman, Julianne, 23 years. And I've been sober and whole from my sexual addiction for 20 years.
Wow. That's great. How did you do that? How did you, you know, you got that day where everything changed, the moment of mental clarity, as we would say in the recovery community. What did you do then? What steps did you take to overcome this, Michael?
That's a great question, and I wish I could give you an easy answer. Because I had grown up in the 12 steps and AA, at that point in my life, I had an aversion to the program, even though right now one of the first things I do is recommend and get people into 12-step programs. I was in the middle of a second graduate degree in counseling. This happened to be in a pastoral counseling program. So I was surrounded by people who were experts in their field and who spoke into my life and walked beside me. I did a lot of reading over the 20-year period. I did a lot of counseling. I didn't like it, but I was forced to deal with my trauma and my abuse. And although I was able to get sobriety very quickly, I never recovered wholeness until many, many years later. And so there's a big difference between sobriety and freedom. You know, sobriety is the absence of a behavior as we typically define it, but the word sober actually means of sound mind and good judgment. And most people, or many people, and I was certainly of this case, I was walking around as a kind of dry drunk for a long time. I was no longer acting out sexually, but I had some undiagnosed trauma. I was still irritable all the time. I was still living with a sense of, you know, at any minute I'm going to be found out for who I really am. I had a whole set of core beliefs of being an unworthy, unlovable person, that if anybody really knew me, they couldn't love me. And a core commitment in my soul that I learned early on that if I'm going to get my needs met, emotionally speaking, I've got to take care of myself. And I would say, you know, even up until recently and ongoingly, the work of recovery is that I'm continuing to get back truth as opposed to falsehood, continuing to get back more and more of my heart, a wholeness of heart instead of brokenness, that there's a recovery of just life and aliveness in my soul. And so I'm a big fan of talking about freedom as opposed to just sobriety. And part of my dad's story was he was sober for 5 years. And when I was in second grade, we all know the proverbial when the doo-doo hits the fan. My dad was a blue-collar worker, and he got up in the middle of the night to go to work. And he stepped in dog poop that was in the house, that the dog had been sick. And he disappeared for a period of a couple of weeks. He just went out on a bender, and I don't think anybody knew where he was. At the end of that 2 weeks is when he went into treatment and has been sober ever since, 43 years ago. And so I'm very just immersed and grew up with the idea of the dry drunk. And that's why I'm so committed to writing and teaching and speaking about this idea that freedom is really available. We never stop working our program. We never stop working our recovery. But there's so much more available than just sobriety of I'm not doing something. You know, we are meant to truly be transformed and made whole.
I love that, Bill, and it goes to the theme of this show, Michael, because what if somebody gets sober and they don't get saved? I think sometimes we have too low a bar here in the recovery community for people to just stop a behavior and not develop a relationship with the living God. And one of my favorite recovery verses is John 10:10. I came to give you life abundantly, and just avoiding a behavior is an abundant life.
Exactly. And it also comes back to the first step that you guys started out with, and that is that, I mean, ultimately our salvation is not in the 12 steps, right? It's in Jesus who said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. But our salvation with Jesus comes only when we say, I'm powerless. I can't save myself. And that's the beauty of the 12 steps as they emerged out of a distinctly Christian context, is that what we're saying when we, whatever language you use, pray to receive Christ or accept Christ or acknowledge him as your Lord and Savior, we're saying I'm powerless and I can't do it myself. Unfortunately, I'm an evangelical, but most evangelical thought in the last 150 years has been about going to heaven as opposed to salvation now. And the scriptures are very clear that we need to have an experience of belief and commitment to God for salvation. But you mentioned John 10:10, that it's for now. It doesn't start, you know, the moment we die and then we're in heaven. And so that abundance, that fullness, in John 10:10, I love how it was translated in the Message paraphrase, where it says that I have come to bring life spilling and brimming over. So it's a picture of a bucket with a hose in it, where there's something being infused inward, and it's so powerful and it's so real that there's just this spilling over. And I don't meet very many believers who have that kind of spilling over, but interestingly, I tend to meet people who have done their recovery work and who have really gone deep into more than just sobriety, who they do have a vibrancy and a vitality to their life. But yeah, the whole point of recovery is ultimately to find God and to find life with a capital L and to live out the purpose that he has us here for.
Michael, I have a question. I want to back up just a little bit, because when you talked about the worst day and the best day of your life, obviously you come home and your secret has been exposed and you've just blown up your wife's life, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now I'm just curious about the space she is in where her mind is going and how she's reacting. If you're at liberty to say that, I would love to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anybody wants to hear a free talk, they can go to our website, restoringthesoul.com, and there's a talk that she has given called Devastated But Not Destroyed. And devastated would be an understatement for her. We had no children at the time. I was still in graduate school, and so she could have walked. But she felt very clearly that God was saying to her, even though you have, quote-unquote, biblical grounds for leaving your husband, I don't want you to do that because you're both going to miss out on something. She, in many ways, was God's face of grace and mercy to me. But she has had to wrestle with her own issues of betrayal and how that opened the door to brokenness in her heart that was there long before she met me. I mean, we're all wounded individuals. And for her, it tapped into every wound, every betrayal, every form of abuse that she had ever experienced. And really, her worst lie was nobody would really love me just for me. And many women live with this lie of, you know, really the only thing men want, there's one thing they want, and that's sex. You know, and then as long as I'm doing the laundry and cooking and keeping the house clean, then, you know, things are good. And in many ways, that's kind of the lie of Depression-era parents that she grew up with. And so my behavior struck deeply into that, and it began a long healing process for her, not just of the adultery and the sexual addiction and how that impacted her, but more deeply how she was broken apart from me. And it really opened the door to, we're two broken people that need Christ to make us whole. And what in the world does that mean, and how in the world do we walk that out? And so very, very, very hard days for many years. And because we're both such complex and broken people from the beginning, I would describe that we've had a very hard but a very good marriage. And largely because of the addiction and how that set things into motion very early on.
Michael, I don't know how to phrase this, so I'm just going to come out with it, that I think for a lot of us, myself included, my thoughts about sex and the excitement of that, when I did get married after a couple years, that gets kind of routine, and I wound up losing my marriage because I did have an affair, and I wasn't able to put it back together. But I'm wondering, how do we change and have an exciting sex life in marriage with intimacy that we're supposed to? I don't think most men know how to do that. I certainly didn't. Any insight on that? And I think it starts from the, you know, you find the Playboy when you're young, and that's exciting, and sex is basically bad to have it to be good. And if it's not bad, then it isn't good. Do you follow me on that?
Yeah, and fantastic question. That's where I always wish that, you know, we had 3 hours or where I could come and do a men's retreat or something for all your listeners, or a retreat in general. And the first thing I would say is that sex is not about sex any more than the love of cars is about Mercedes-Benz. You know, love of Mercedes is about Mercedes. But what I want to say is that the title for my book, Surfing for God, people will say, well, why surfing for God? Where did that come from? The Catholic writer at the beginning of the 20th century, G.K. Chesterton, said that the man knocking on the brothel door is knocking for God.
Michael, we're going to ask you to just hold it from there. And then when we come back, we're going to pick up exactly where you left off. Been a fascinating conversation we're having tonight with Michael Cusick. Thanks for being with us on Real Recovery. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Thanks for staying with us tonight. Bill Arnold, George Fraser, Aaron on the board tonight. And we're talking to Michael Cusick, who's written an absolutely fascinating book called Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Desire. His website is restoringthesoul.org. Is that right, Michael?
.com.
.com. I'm sorry. Restoringthesoul.com. And
that's it.
Sorry?
That's it. You got it.
Okay. Anyway, George, you had a nice question for Michael, and I kind of cut you off. Do you remember where you were, and can you pick up from there?
He's talking about G.K. Chesterton.
G.K. Chesterton, exactly.
Yeah, Chesterton said that the man knocking on the brothel door is knocking for God. And when I first heard that, I went, man, something about that deeply resonates in me, because it feels like there is an emotional and spiritual hunger in my heart as I'm looking at porn, as I'm pursuing prostitutes, as I was trying to pick up women at bars and stuff. It seems like there's a hunger that's deeper than what I can satisfy it with. And so the lights came on when I read that. And I'm also a professor by training. And so as I was preparing for an addictions class that I taught, I started thinking, as I was preparing a unit on porn addiction, what if Chesterton was right in that the man knocking on the door is knocking for God when he's at a brothel? Maybe the guy who's surfing the internet for porn is surfing for God. And so I really believe that when we're looking at porn online, when we're lusting after an attractive woman, you know, and we're sitting next to our wife, we're not actually lusting after sex. And to answer your question about how does a man have an exciting sex life, which is an absolutely legitimate, valid thing in his marriage, is first to realize that it's not about sex. It's about an emotional, relational, spiritual longing in his heart, which is why in my book, I say that we have to come to terms with our desires. And for any addiction, if you want to go below the surface of just changing your behavior, you need to realize, what were you really longing for? So the alcoholic who has a couple glasses of scotch or a six-pack of beer, it's not just that, oh, yeah, I want to relieve my stress, but the longing underneath that is a longing for rest, a longing for heaven, a longing for a sense of peace. It was Thomas Aquinas who said that beneath every sinful behavior is a legitimate God-given appetite. So I would ask the coke addict or the alcoholic, what is the appetite beneath your behavior? And so the appetite, in addition to just, hey, I want to have sex and I want to, you know, get it on with my spouse, is there's longings in our heart. I talk about seven core longings: for attention, for affection, for affirmation, for acceptance, for security, significance, and satisfaction. And so many, many, many marriages, whether there's addicts involved or not, sex can either be a substitute for an emotional, relational, spiritual connection, and there's no intimacy in the marriage, but couples are sexually active, or there's no emotional, spiritual, relational intimacy, and there's no sex going on, which then oftentimes leads to all kinds of issues like frustration, anger, distance, etc. But for someone who wants to have an exciting sex life, I would say and argue that the best sex happens inside of a marriage, because inside of a marriage, there's the greatest capacity for an emotional and spiritual connection. If you think of a triangle, the base of the triangle would be emotional oneness or intimacy. Above that would be spiritual intimacy and oneness. And then at the tip of that triangle would be physical intimacy. And the way God designed it is that the physical intimacy is meant to be the icing on the cake and the overflow, if you will, of what's already in place emotionally and spiritually. And that's why the age-old wisdom that sounds almost cliche is, you know, that sex starts in the kitchen when the husbands wash the dishes, or when spouses are kind to one another and when they're sitting down and talking and that kind of thing. Because the best sex is not just physical, it's holistic. It's heart, body, mind, soul, spirit.
Michael, then one of the questions I have, when you said the base would be trust, what happens when trust has been shattered? And is it, how long is a reasonable amount of time, and how much proving needs to go on to start to go, I think the trust is there? I mean, sometimes I say to the guys I work with, don't tell me something, just don't promise anything, just prove it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
We need actions.
Yeah, trust is a funny thing where it certainly does need to be earned. And sometimes people will say, you know, I've done everything you've asked me to and you're still not trusting me. And a spouse may say, I don't know what it is. It's just something's not right. And frankly, I think that can be because people will go through the motions and do everything right, but they've not dealt with their heart. So in Matthew chapter 15, Jesus has this fascinating conversation with the Pharisees, who were the religious, you know, righteous guys. They did everything right. And he said some stinging words to them. He said, you honor me with your lips, but your hearts are far from me and your worship is in vain. And what the God of the universe was saying was, you know, okay, so you follow the jot and tittle of the law, but your heart is just not in it, and I want your heart. And so in rebuilding trust, the big question is not, have you been clean and sober? Have you looked at porn in the case of porn addiction or sex addiction? But where is your heart, and how connected to your heart do I feel? I've worked with spouses and couples where the person has followed the letter of the law, and they, on the outside, have regained trust completely, but the spouse goes, something's not right. And I've also worked with people who continue to have falls, relapses, and slip-ups, and yet the spouse feels their heart, and they feel newly engaged with them, and they feel like the person is present in a way before, and they trust them more than if they had never slipped up. So it's a complicated issue. And then finally, for the spouse that has difficulty trusting sometimes, after enough time has gone by, if there's still not trust, and the addict feels like, man, I really feel like I'm in a good place, sometimes the spouse who's having difficulty trusting needs to look inward at their own heart and soul and say, where am I broken, and where is trust difficult for reasons that are bigger than my addicted spouse?
I would think that, it makes a lot of sense, but I think that spouse could be really resentful saying, oh, wait a minute, you had an affair, and now you're telling me I've got something broken inside?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I want to come out swinging, then that'd be the case.
Right, right. But you know, one of my favorite quotes about marriage is not a Bible verse. It's it says, marriage is our last best chance to grow up. And that's certainly been true for me, is that I want to grow up. Whether I take my last breath when I'm 90 or today, I want to grow up into becoming the person that I was meant to be, to mature, to develop fully. And my spouse is the person who can best help me do that, and she would say that I'm the person that can best help her do that. So especially an addict who has caused pain and who has betrayed, they need to be very careful with their words. They need to be very patient and see that they're now being given a role to speak into the life of the other person. And when the other person says, well, hey, this isn't my issue, then to back off and say, I'm not saying it's your issue. I'm saying that maybe, just maybe, there's something that God is wanting you to pay attention to inside of your heart. And that can get very complex, and that's sometimes where counselors and therapists can come in, not just as handy, but as a necessity for people to do the deepest recovery. I encourage couples, and I say, you know, this is not as good as it gets. You don't want to just get to a point where there's no longer conflict or pain. You want to press into actual, real intimacy. And intimacy begins with a knowledge of self. To be intimate with another, I have to deeply know myself. So, yeah, it can get complex. It can get a little thorny. But that's just a factor that I see very, very often.
How do you show grace when you're so upset? If you're the spouse, basically, isn't your thinking, all right, you messed up, therefore I can be as mean to you as I want to be, because it's your
fault.
Well,
I think that everyone can have a free pass and is under grace in terms of course it's right to be angry, and of course it's right to not just smile and say, oh, I forgive you. You know, because I get concerned, and it's very unhealthy a lot of times when people, for unhealthy spiritual reasons, will say, oh, I just forgive you, let's move on. That's denial.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it says in the Gospel of Luke that he who has been forgiven much loves much. And so the person who can be magnanimous and extravagant with grace is the person who's experienced grace in their own life. And, you know, that's why if an alcoholic goes to AA, Al-Anon was not just created for, oh, you know, these lonely women in the 1950s need someone to talk to, but rather realizing that there's a system that's in place, that the co-addict never causes the addiction or the behavior choice that the person makes, but that person's addiction puts a system in place, and the system needs to be healed, and that includes two individuals that make a whole. But two people who are becoming relatively whole make a whole, not two broken individuals. Most marriages, Dr. Larry Crabb said, are like two ticks and no dog. And so addiction allows us to ask the question, you know, how am I in some ways leaning into and bending into my spouse to draw life from them and asking them to make me whole instead of God?
I did an event with Dr. Larry Crabb years and years ago, and I remember him saying to the group that he was laying in bed one night with his wife, 5 inches apart physically and 5 miles apart emotionally. And his wife said, "Do you think we'll make it?" And he said, "I don't know." And he said, "I just got done writing a book called How to Have a Good Marriage." He said, "Do you ever feel like a hypocrite?"
So, you know, and so often, especially when you add in Christianity into the dimension of addiction, there's so many pressures and expectations for what it means to be a good Christian or a good person that we don't talk about our brokenness. And I know Larry very, very well. He was my mentor. And the reason why he would talk about those things is because he knew that that gives permission to people to be broken and to be powerless and to say, yeah, that's really my reality right now. And, you know, in my book, there's a quote that says that Jesus can only meet us in our realities, not in our illusions. And I think that there's too many relationships and marriages out there that they look great on the outside. But if people ask, am I happy? Am I connected? Is there real intimacy here? You know, the answer is I don't think so. And so one of my soapboxes is again and again and again, I believe that the greatest lie from the evil one that he's perpetrated upon followers of Jesus is that this is as good as it gets. And whether that's the person listening to this podcast who's addicted to porn, but maybe been clean and sober from a substance, the lie in their head is yeah, this is as good as it gets. I really got free from alcohol or drugs or gambling or spending or food, but you know, porn, that's just too shameful, so I can't go there. This is as good as it gets. Thank the Lord I'm forgiven, but I'll never really be free. And I want to say, no, it's not. We have to come back to the words of Jesus. I have come to bring life abundantly. And that's in contrast to what the evil one wants to do, to steal, to kill, and destroy. If the gospel means anything at all, it means that God is so good in Jesus that we can experience real transformation and restoration on this side of heaven that really gives us a taste of who we will be in heaven. Not completely, but a substantial taste, and we can experience substantial healing.
Michael, we got to take a short break. We'll be back in just a minute. You listen to Real Recovery. Be back in a minute. We are back. Thanks for staying with us tonight on Real Recovery. We've got quite a guest in studio. Well, not in. We're in studio, George. You and me are.
I thought we were. Yeah. Thank you.
No, it'd be great if Michael was here in studio, but he's not. He's in Colorado.
Gosh, I'm learning a lot tonight.
I'm taking copious notes. You know what copious means?
Yes.
I don't mean to be condescending.
Well, you were, and thank you. I'm used to it. I get condescended on a lot. I don't know if that's a word. I got a question as long as we're on this. I agree with everything you've said tonight, and I'm learning a lot, Michael. But I come to you. I've got a problem with my sex thoughts, maybe some porn issues. What's my action plan? How do I get started on this, and what do I do? What's my roadmap?
Well, forgive the alliteration, but I'll talk about several R's. The first thing is to recognize, and you know, it's the lights coming on, and I'm having a problem. And we know from research on addiction that there's six broad stages of addiction, and it's not until somebody gets to the third stage of actually counting the cost that they can actually make real changes. But the first thing is to realize, to recognize that I have a problem. And that the fact with pornography and lust is that porn is as much a drug as cocaine or heroin or alcohol. And the thing that we are addicted to, the substance, is our own brain chemistry. Because just thinking about a sexual or erotic enticing image elicits dopamine in the brain. And so it's a drug, and we're addicted to our own brain chemistry. And the more that a person can find out about the brain, the better. Because what that does is it takes away layers and layers of shame of, I'm a terrible person, I'm a bad Christian, I'm morally weak that I can't overcome this, et cetera, et cetera. And so recognizing that it's a problem and recognizing that it's a drug. The second thing is to reach out. You cannot, and anyone who's listened to your show for any amount of time or been in recovery for any amount of time knows that an addict cannot heal alone. Now, a person might stop a behavior or an addiction, but they're not going to change internally. And we are transformed in community. We were not meant for isolation. We're created for deep relationship and connection. And so to reach out and to risk being known. And there's always that voice that says, no, nobody could love me for who I am, or this would be too shameful. And I think that a person should start where it feels most natural. So sometimes that's a friend. Sometimes that's a sponsor in another recovery program. Sometimes it's a spouse with whom we need to come clean with. The third thing is to begin a process of rebooting. And you talked about that earlier. And in my book, there's a chapter about rebooting and rewiring the brain. And rebooting is a point of beginning with a start date and like resetting a computer when the little window or the wheel, depending on what kind of computer you have, goes on and on and on and your computer's frozen. You've got to hold down that button and reboot it. So it literally turns off, and then when it comes back on, it resets itself. And our brains can be rebooted in that kind of way. For porn and sex addiction, guys hear about this and they go, oh, but, you know, dude, I've tried that before, and this is the 1,033rd time that I'm going to be trying to stop. And I'll say, well, try it another time, but now with a whole new sense that you're not wrestling against your willpower. You are now working and rebooting to rewire your brain pathways. And it's almost like someone who gets irritable all the time who learns, wow, I have low blood sugar. That's why I'm irritable. And now they are no longer trying not to be irritable, which is kind of a strange goal. They're trying to learn to eat right and maintain their blood sugar so that they don't become irritable. It's a whole different focus, which is really a game changer in recovery from sex addiction, because Christians think, oh, I tried, I failed, I'm either a bad Christian or there's something wrong with me. And in fact, there's something wrong with the brain. So the rebooting process is something that in my book, we talk about a 90-day reboot, and it's generally that amount of time that it takes to reset and begin to rewire the brain pathways in substantial ways. The next R is reorientation. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, interestingly, that the suppression or the pursuit of purity is not about suppressing lust, but about reorienting our life to a larger goal. And reorienting is looking out and beyond yourself, where the addiction has made our life small and very preoccupied. And a great illustration with this is a friend of mine has a pit bull, and the pit bull picked up his infant son's little crib toy, but the kid would not go to sleep without this crib toy. And the pit bull was literally starting to devour it. And the father and the grandfather were trying to pull this toy out of the dog's mouth, and they couldn't get it out. The grandmother walks over with a little piece of hot dog and says, "Here, Rosie," to the dog. Rosie dropped this toy that it was destroying and goes and starts chewing on the hot dog. She offered a more compelling, attractive alternative to chewing on the toy. And reorienting our life with any addiction is developing passions and giving our heart to things that truly satisfy our appetites and that are more compelling. And for the Christian, that means we need to find ways to relate to God that seem like God is actually better than and more appetizing than pornography. But reorienting is we've got to find that hot dog. We've got to find that steak or the something that goes, yes, this is what my heart longs for. As we begin to reorient our life, it's like opening up a faucet of life and passion and desire, as opposed to taking a faucet with fetid water that's coming out of it and turning that faucet off. A lot of approaches to addiction are more about closing the faucet than opening a faucet, and that's really what reorientation is. As we do that, we will experience restoration as we pursue community and as we pursue the truth and as we pursue wholeness. So those are some, I think, five R's that are a good beginning point.
That's fascinating. Michael, we had a question into the program on the web. It's and the listener says, in discovering a spouse's affair, the husband also reveals that he's been addicted to pornography since childhood. Now, obviously, that's come as a big shock and surprise, because that's something that was conducted in secret all along. But now the affair has been exposed. What would be the recommended approach? The question is, do they work together to deal with the affair first, or do they try to deal with both issues at the same time?
Oh, man, that's such a hard one. But generally speaking, when there's an affair like that, a couple will need some kind of triage. And so I'd say you've got to deal with the affair, especially on the front end, to acknowledge the deep betrayal, to acknowledge that this wasn't just, you know, a mistake, and to forgive and to forget. But to, as one author, David Carter, in his book Torn Asunder, he's a professor at Fuller Seminary in California, and Torn Asunder, he says that the key with an affair is for the counselor and the couple to decode the message of the affair. And oftentimes the message of the affair is simply there's absolutely no intimacy in the relationship. For someone with a porn addiction since childhood, part of the message of the affair is there's at least one person in the marriage who, because of being addicted to porn, doesn't know how to be intimate, doesn't know how to do intimacy, doesn't know how to have real legitimate needs because you can turn to porn every time to meet those needs. And so there would need to be a concurrent treatment of sexual addiction. And I'm making a massive assumption there. It doesn't necessarily – I would say that with the porn addiction, there's a sexual addiction there, and the affair is simply a symptom of that porn addiction. So that person would need to go into recovery for their sex addiction, porn addiction, and simultaneously work on the marriage. Very often, when I'm working with couples, I'll say, you know, I can't do much with the marriage until you make some progress in your own recovery. And so it's a kind of delicate balance, but definitely some help for the marriage on the front end and definitely recovery for that individual.
Are some of the intensive rehab therapy programs, I know you have workshops that last 3 days. I know you've got one coming up in Colorado Springs this month. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually next Wednesday. Unfortunately, our registration for that is closed because we are full at capacity. We have 30 men that meet for 3.5 days. It's called the Surfing for God Intensive Weekend, and okay. We walk through the message of Surfing for God. But we also do Restoring the Soul is my ministry, and we do intensives with couples and individuals. So people who are wanting to do something kind of preventative and proactive, they can come for 1 week. Couples and individuals where the bottom has fallen out and they're in a kind of crisis and they're trying to put their brokenness back together, that's a 2-week intensive. And both of those programs are 3 hours a day, Monday through Friday. You take the weekend off and then you come back again. And so there's either 15 or 30 hours of contact, which allows you to do roughly 4 to 9 months of counseling in a 2-week period of time. And I've done that for 12 years and worked with hundreds and hundreds of couples. And it's really been a powerful transformational tool for recovery and healing in people's hearts and in their marriages.
Michael, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to ask a question that is, when it comes to men and intimacy, now they've been exposed and they have to get more intimate, and that scares them too. So isn't that like one of the biggest jobs out there, to try to help pastor men and train them to try to become vulnerable and intimate without having to panic and flee?
Yeah, absolutely. My passion and my personal mission statement is to help men recover and live from their true heart, their deep heart, their soul. And interestingly, when a guy gets caught, and sometimes it's the other way around, it's a woman who's a sex addict, but when someone gets caught and they come clean and they're in a position of living out step one where they're powerless, where they're humble, I will hear from probably 50% of the couples, we feel more connected and closer and more intimate than we've ever felt. As a matter of fact, we don't think we've ever had intimacy until now. And that's usually because, in the case of a male addict, the wife will say, I've never really felt his heart before. You know, and now he's crying every day in front of me, and not just saying he's sorry, but he's telling me about his abuse and his past, and he's being vulnerable. And it's oftentimes these kinds of failures and places of powerlessness that God uses, as the Catholic Franciscan Richard Rohr says, that it's in these places that God allows us to break out and God to break in to our soul. And so when a spouse goes, gosh, I feel like I know their soul for the first time, it becomes really powerful. And then there's a momentum there that I try to help people keep going. See, we all long to be deeply known and loved, and we all have at some level this belief that, well, if people really knew me, they wouldn't love me.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, and so addiction is a gift of sorts that allows all of what we really long for to be right there out on the table, and will we trust grace to be big enough to be able to absorb the addiction? And the answer is yes, grace can absorb an addiction.
Michael, you've just been a spectacular guest. I just can't thank you enough for being on the show. His book is Surfing for God, and his website is restoringthesoul.com. Go check it out. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight, and thank you for listening to Real Recovery. Have a great week, everyone. Good night, and God bless.
Hi, my name is Tammy. When Emma became a teenager, I just watched her personality change so much. I was afraid she was into drugs, and I had no idea what was going on. She was hurting so bad. And I tried everything, and I could not reach her. And she did get involved in the drug lifestyle. I watched her be handcuffed by the police and go to jail twice. I found myself in a place where all I could do was stand and pray. But I also found that was a very powerful place to be. I prayed months and months for my daughter, with no visible change. But then one day, she began to open up to me, and she said she would go to Teen Challenge. She began to grow and blossom and began to heal. And with that healing, she has become a powerful woman of God. She's left her drug use behind and become the most beautiful and precious woman of God I've ever known. God's intervention in Emma's life has been an intervention to our whole family. And I cannot express how thankful I am. Coming to Teen Challenge has saved Emma's life, and it has completely changed mine.